From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 20 years after her death, we're talking about the life and work of one of the greatest screen actresses of all time, Ingrid Bergman.
Can I tell you a story, Ricky?
You got a wow finish?
I don't know the finish yet.
Well, go on, tell it. Maybe one will come to you as you go along.
It's about a girl who had just come to Paris from her home in Oslo. At the house of some friends, she met a man about whom she had heard her whole life. A very great and courageous man. He opened up for her a whole beautiful world full of knowledge and thoughts and ideals. Everything she knew or ever became was because of him. And she looked up to him and worshipped him with a feeling she supposed was love.
Woman needs man, and man must have his man.
Even before Bogey and Casablanca, the story of Ingrid Bergman was the story of a meteoric Hollywood ascent, the story of a woman so loved for her beauty, her intriguing accent, her effortless naturalism in front of the camera, that she was hailed as one of the first great modern screen actresses. But it's also the story of a great fall, of a woman vilified in the days of the Red Scare and 1950s morality for a wild affair and an out-of-wedlock pregnancy that left her exiled from the country and people that had made her a cinema saint. The story of Ingrid Bergman ends as a story of vindication, of an actress forgiven who went on to win two more Academy Awards and live in legend as one of the most beloved Hollywood figures of all time. We're talking this hour about the life and movies of Ingrid Bergman. Does her talent and allure in movies like Casablanca, Gaslight, and Notorious capture us as strongly today as it did more than half a century ago? What is the Bergman moment that stands in your mind as a favorite? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us in the studio is Garen Daly, owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, and On Point's movie maven. Welcome once again, Garen Daly.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. And from Middletown, Connecticut, we're joined tonight by Janine Basinger, professor of film studies at Wesleyan University and curator of the Wesleyan Cinema Archives. Welcome, Janine Basinger.
Hi, thank you.
It's so great to have you.
Thank you.
Garen, I have... compliments of your tall stack of videos. I've been back in Ingrid Bergman land for the last couple of days, and oh my gosh, I'm just melted. She's got me completely in the palm of her hand. What is it, what was it about this actress that set her apart from what came before? What makes her so special even today?
Well, you know, she is an actress who, as you said at the beginning, is very natural in front of the camera. And that seemed to be a departure for some of the actresses that came out of the 20s and 30s. And at the same time, she was able to have the audience respond to her in such a positive manner. As a person watching these films, you identify with her, you care about her, and it's almost, you know, she's a star. And Samuel Golden once said, "God makes stars, people admire his handiwork." And she has that handiwork. She is just an incredibly luminous person. She seems to glow off the screen. Her eyes are just, you know, you watch her eyes and they are so expressive. And at the same time, she's a very forceful person. Not just a woman, a forceful person who's very sure of herself. And that comes across and we respond to that in incredibly positive ways.
Janine Basinger, you have followed lots of Hollywood stars and know them well. In your cinema archives at Wesleyan, you've got Ingrid Bergman's papers. You clearly paid a lot of attention to her. What's your sense of what made her special at the time when she first came on the American Hollywood scene in the late 30s into the 40s? What was it that made people say, wait a minute, who's this?
Well, you can never overlook the basic thing, which is she's stunningly beautiful.
She's
stunningly beautiful. And she's also a talented actress. I mean, that's a pretty solid foundation. Mm-hmm. But the thing about her is she was natural. She did not pluck her eyebrows. She was not heavily shellacked and made up. Her hair was natural. It's very interesting. In the archive, we have the assessments of her when she first came, primarily by David Selznick, who said, well, can't we do something with her?
Can we gussy her up a little bit?
Right, you know, and you read it, he says, you know, she's not going to look good in a bathing suit. Her hips are too big. When you read something like that, you know, it stands your hair right on end. I mean, but
well, this
course,
was coming out of the era of Marlena Dietrich
exactly.
And Greta Garbo, who were highly stylized
exactly.
actresses.
Exactly. So, but I mean, the fact is she said, no, you won't do anything with me. That's not who I am. It won't work. And, of course, once they turned the camera on her in this the screen test that David O. Selznick did, he saw instantly that this was true, that there was no need to do anything with her. She was luminously beautiful and could act.
Garen Daly, give us the basic ABCs of where Ingrid Bergman came from. What was her background, and how did she end up on screen?
Well, she was going to the, I believe it's the Swedish Theatrical Academy to learn acting. And
take us even further back. She had lost both of her parents, isn't that right?
That is correct, yes. And she decided that she wanted to go on stage. That's what she wanted to do more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And she ended up going to the, I think it's a Swedish theatrical company, where she learned how to act. She did a bunch, a couple of films. And in 1936, she made Intermezzo. And she was just incredible. The first words that she says are just, you just know that this is going to be a star.
This is the Made in Sweden Intermezzo.
1936 version, yes.
Let's listen.
Intressant, fröken Hoffmann. Vi ska inte se nej väg. Vi har inte så brått efter äran och berömmelsen.
Nej, de är välkomna när de kommer. Om de kommer.
Om?
Ingrid Bergman, Intermezzo, at least the Swedish version. We don't all speak Swedish, Garen Daly. What's she saying?
Well, it's actually very ironic or very presages what's happening. What's happening is that she is this young pianist, and these two guys are talking about, oh, how she's going to be great, but they're going to take care because fame and honors are going to come when they come. And she says, yes, fame and honor will come if they come.
And Intermezzo took her pretty quickly to Hollywood.
Well, what happened was one of the guys who was working in David Selznick's offices was from Swedish descent. His parents saw the film, said it was a great film that he should see it. He went and saw it. He liked her. He bought the rights to the film, and in 1939 he brought it to the United States, and they made a remake of Intermezzo. And Intermezzo, the 1939 version, is her first American film.
Janine Basinger, who was this rather young woman coming to Hollywood and very quickly right into the heart of it? She had lost her parents. What were the most important circumstances of her childhood?
Well, we have a complete record of Ingrid Bergman's life in our archive. It's an interesting thing to note because she was a person who, although she moved numerous times internationally, saved every scrap of paper that pertained to her personal life. Obviously, because she had lost her parents, she clung to everything. And we can tell you just about anything you want to know.
Well, her
about
father was a photographer, if I understand.
Yes, and the loving presence of the camera is a key element in her development as a screen personality.
Can we read too much into that, or does
no.
that make the camera a kind of totem of her father's presence,
it,
even
it
after he was gone?
It definitely makes it a totem of her father's presence, and she definitely knew that and definitely said it many times in her life. He took photographs of her continuously, and there's an enormous record of her photographically. She was a beautiful baby, obviously, a beautiful little girl, a beautiful young girl, and she is not, you can see very clearly that she turns to the camera as she would turn to a father that she loved. She was comfortable having her picture taken. She was comfortable having a camera come up close and look at her, and that helped her enormously as a film star.
Especially in film as opposed to stage. I mean,
right.
It's all about being up close.
She went to the Royal Dramatic Theater School, by the way, and it's an enormously successful school, but she didn't stay there too long because she did debut in film rather early in 1934. She got a contract with Vince Film Industry, and she emerged very rapidly because of her beauty.
Garen Daly, Intermezzo brought her to the United States. What was it that David Selznick, that the American public saw in this beautiful face with a sort of tragic childhood behind it? What was the instant appeal?
Well, what I think it is that she seemed to embody many different things. First of all, America at that time was a very small, very puritanical and very tight society, and she seemed to bring a little worldliness to America, and at the same time, she seemed to espouse the same values. So on one side, she's being very, very American and very puritanical, and on the other side, she's carrying a past, and the past almost seems to come from her voice with the slight accent and the naturalness of what she has in her acting ability. So the two of those kind of joined together to create a different kind of star that we hadn't seen before.
A very natural effect. She was very quickly teamed up with big names in Hollywood.
And she held her own with these people. For instance, in the 1941 film Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, she's going against Academy Award winner Spencer Tracy, who I consider to be one of the great American actors, and she really just holds her own in a very tight scene.
You must sing for me.
No. Oh, no, not that.
Why not?
Not that.
Not in good voice?
Oh, it isn't that, sir.
Oh, but it's such a pretty song.
Oh, please, not tonight.
Oh, yeah. Sing it moodily. See it
my God, I can't.
You hear me? Sing it. Sing it.
You should see me dance the polka. You should see me cover the ground. You should see my bustles flying. When I whirl my pot.
Smile when you sing. Be happy. Be gay.
When the band commences playing.
That's it.
My feet begin to go.
That's it. That's it. That's it.
For the rollicking, jumping polka.
That's it.
It's the funniest thing I know. Oh, no.
Ingrid Bergman playing a streetwalker in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, 1941, opposite Spencer Tracy. Jeanine Basinger, she was not choosing a film here that would make her look like peaches and cream, wholesome Americana. She actively chose this part, which was a little bit rougher and mussed around the edges.
Well, she was originally cast in the other role, that of the sweetheart that he loves, the pure girl who was played in the end by Lana Turner. They reversed the roles. And Ingrid Bergman was always very intelligent about knowing what kind of challenges could lie inside a role. And she knew that she would be much better off playing this part. And she's wonderful. And I thought that was an excellent description of what made her appealing that your other guest gave when he said, you know, she was wholesome, but mm-hmm. she also had European sophistication. And I think that's very intelligent, and it really is true. She combined. She was sexy and European and sophisticated, but she looked so wholesome and corn-fed at the same time.
Mm. Garen Daly, I saw in Intermezzo, the Swedish version, and here in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, also her ability as an actress to ride that line between laughter and horror, you know, laughing and tears. There was that beauty, but also the sense of a kind of ominous shadow behind.
Yeah, again, I think it's that episode or that feeling that there's a past there, and you don't know whether that past is going to like just come up and rear its ugly head at any moment. It's sort of like she's a comic ready to explode, but she's always restrained. And in one of her other earlier films, like the Hitchcock film Spellbound, mm-hmm. she does a completely different thing where she now becomes the working gal. She's an intelligent woman who's gone to college and she's become a psychiatrist. And now she's fallen in love with a guy.
Gregory Peck,
who is really, really disturbed and sick. And in the typical Hollywood, very simplistic Freudian language, she is trying to figure out a way to save and rescue him.
Just a few more days, Alex, before you turn him over. Just a few more days, and then if I can't do anything, if we both can't, well, then you can call the police. You're not hiding a criminal. There is no evidence against him except his own guilt fantasies. He's wanted only as a possible witness as to what happened to Dr. Edwards. Well, in his present condition, he could tell the police nothing. Don't you see you're doing nothing against the law? We are helping them by investigating the patient as doctors. Doctors who want the truth even more than they do.
Ingrid Bergman, opposite Gregory Peck in the 1945 Spellbound. Jeanine Basinger, was she seen as a character actress or one who could go into a wide variety of roles?
Well, she was lucky to be considered to be one of the great, beautiful actresses who would be allowed to play roles that had some character to them or some subtlety or some dimension. She wasn't just cast as the beautiful leading lady. In Spellbound, of course, she uses her strength and helps the impaired leading man. But in a film like Gaslight, you know, she puts forward her own weaknesses and has to, you know, gather her strength in order her to fight back the leading man. She was able to go in several different directions, and of course she could play with a light touch comedically as well as the deepest of tragedy.
We're talking about Ingrid Bergman tonight. The anniversary, 20th anniversary of her death was yesterday. Did you love Ingrid Bergman? Do you still? Does she still get smoke in your eyes? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the life and work of Ingrid Bergman on the 20th anniversary of her death. Our guests are Garen Daly, On Point's movie maven, and Janine Basinger, professor of film studies at Wesleyan University and curator of the Wesleyan Cinema Archives. There are a lot of beautiful women on screen. What was it that set Ingrid Bergman apart? She was a phenom in her day. Would she still be today? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Here's Ingrid Bergman, 1945, playing a nun in Bells of St. Mary's.
You don't become a nun to run away from life, Betsy. It's not because you've lost something. It's because you found something. You're still a little girl. You don't know yet.
Oh, but I do. I just want to be like you.
You don't know what the next 4 years will bring. You haven't been to high school yet. Those are years you'll always treasure. New companions, new interests, lots of fun, as well as study. Going to parties, to football games, your first prom, your first waltz. You can't give up these things if you know nothing about them. Not until you have known all this and more. Can you say with complete understanding, I want to be a nun?
Ingrid Bergman, 1945, in Bells of St. Mary's. Garen Daly, here she is, almost literally put into that sainted position, that sainted role that the American public somehow wanted to superimpose on this young Swedish actress. She's playing a nun, and that kind of saintly character is what the country wanted to believe she really brought.
Not only that, is that, you know, when I was a young altar boy in the town of Durham, Connecticut, just outside of Middletown, Connecticut, I saw this film, and it was like I could feel all that was good about joining a religious order. It was a very inspiring. And so everyone else in the country felt the same thing, that this was a woman who was personifying all the really good qualities of humanity. Mm-hmm. And we bought that, and we grabbed onto that, and we just loved her for that.
Janine Basinger, did she know that that's how she was being typecast in the American public's mind? What was she writing home or writing to her friends about this process?
She certainly understood that she was being promoted in the fan magazines in Hollywood as a wholesome Swedish girl, happily married, the mother of a lovely child. She, you know, you didn't get a lot of choice in those days over how you were promoted, but they did promote her as a happily married, wholesome woman who lived a clean life. And then, of course, when she was cast as a nun in the role, I mean, she understood that was an extension. Of course, her private letters, her diaries, the things that we have, reveal a very different woman, and a woman who was very sophisticated and having affairs and leading a life of her own. So, but she, I think, saw it as this was business, this was her job, and how they sold her to the public was not who she was. She clearly understood the difference. She didn't buy her own publicity, but I don't think she realized the effect that it could ultimately have when it backfired on her.
Give us a sense, Janine Basinger, of how big Ingrid Bergman was in the mid-40s, during the war and after the war.
Ingrid Bergman was a top 10 box office star for several years, and her films, many of her films, were in the top 20 or 25 box office draws. She was one of the most heavily promoted in the film magazine. She had as many magazine covers as anyone in her time, with the possible exception of Betty Grable, the number one box office star of those years, and still the number one box office champion of all female stars in the United States. United States, but she was a hugely popular movie star.
And what did Americans make of her Swedishness, of her accent? She was clearly not American-born. Did it matter in those days?
Well, it didn't matter. It wasn't as if we hadn't heard it before.
I guess not as if an awful lot of Americans
exactly.
didn't have immigrant accents in those days.
Well, and also Drake and, yeah, I mean, many stars. It was not uncommon. And when we moved into the war years in particular, so many actors and actresses immigrated and played roles with accents. And she promoted herself as representing Sweden well. During the war, she made a famous short called Swedes in America. And, you know, she put it forward very straightforwardly. And again, it was our immigrant experience. People didn't really find that strange.
Garen Daly, all that milk-fed look and beauty and everything that was read into it and promoted by the studio system came back to bite Ingrid Bergman a little bit as she moved into a more and more sophisticated world. 1946, she made maybe one of her greatest movies with Alfred Hitchcock.
Yeah, Notorious. And I actually think this may be her best movie because she gets to do things that she hadn't been able to do before, and that is to play a full-bodied, fully realized woman. In the film, she plays a daughter of a Nazi sympathizer. In the beginning of the film, she's partying. She's a little depressed. Cary Grant comes in. He's an agent from the government. They're going to go make good to rehabilitate her by doing some spying for her. And one of the things that I love about this film is this very erotic scene between Cary Grant, who's this agent, and Ingrid Bergman, who's this kind of party bad girl who's going to become a spy. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be kissing and they're going to be making out. Now, what's interesting about this scene is that at that time, I think it was the Hays Commission, said mm-hmm. you could not kiss on screen for more than 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. So Hitchcock, being Hitchcock, said, fine, they'll kiss for 10 seconds and then they'll talk. Then they'll kiss for another 10 seconds and they'll talk. And what came out of it was this incredibly erotic and very moving love scene.
It's nice out here. Let's not go out for dinner. Let's stay here.
We have to eat.
Mm-hmm. What you need here, I'll cook.
I thought you didn't like to cook.
No, I don't like to cook. But I have a chicken in the icebox, and you're eating it.
What about all the washing up after?
We'll eat it with our fingers.
Do we need new plates?
Yes. One for you and one for me.
Do you mind if I have dinner with you tonight?
There it is, Alfred Hitchcock's sex in 1946, Notorious, a chicken in the icebox. We'll be eating with our fingers.
So
we're really in dangerous territory, Janine Basinger.
I know. This is my favorite Ingrid Bergman movie, and it may be my favorite Hitchcock. It may be my favorite Cary Grant. It's just, and that scene is just wonderful, and I'm happy to report that although not all old films can work their magic for today's young audience, my students love this movie, and they find that scene, they always vote that scene the sexiest scene of the movies of whatever year it is.
Well, Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman eating with their fingers and kissing
exactly.
in between. What do you want?
Ingrid Bergman with a chicken in the icebox is their idea of heaven.
She played opposite some of the greatest male leads of all time, Cary Grant, Spencer Tracy, Humphrey Bogart, many others. But things began to get dicey for her. Was she associated romantically with any of these? I know Roberto Rossellini was the great love, but before that came, who were her liaisons, Janine?
Well, you know, I'm not sure how the family would appreciate my giving all the details of Ingrid Bergman's private life.
Is it not public record at this point?
It's fairly well known, yes, that she did have affairs with her leading men, and she certainly had affairs with her directors, Victor Fleming, in particular, Robert Capa, the photographer. She was a woman who lived her own life. She had a strong sense of herself. She was independent. Her marriage was an unhappy one.
This was to a Swedish doctor, I think.
Yes, Peter Lindstrom.
Let me ask you this, Janine. What was her romantic life in the Hollywood context of that day pretty much the norm, or did she bring something continental, something Swedish that was more experimental or liberal than other actresses?
I think it was definitely the norm, and I think if anything, she was more conservative. She did stay heterosexual, and I think that you know, we have kind of an idea that that the old days were tamer than now. That is really not true. I mean, in Hollywood, I think it was fairly. There was a fairly colorful social life going on in all categories, and people in particular who were playing romantic leads together in movies often had affairs. It was not really uncommon.
But at a certain point, Garen Daly, Ingrid Bergman's relationship with one man in particular pushed all this over the edge in the public's mind. Tell us that story.
Well, I think you have to go back to when she went into a theater one day and saw Roberto Rossellini's Open City. She was blown away by the new emerging Italian neorealism, this new form of filmmaking coming out of Italy after the war. She then saw Paisan, which is one of my favorite films. Again, a very powerful example of what you can do with film to drive home really important, dramatic, live, real-life events. And she went after him. She wanted to do some work with him. This is something new and exciting. It was a way for her to explore her own creativity. And what ended up happening was is that they ended up getting together, and I'm sure Janine can give us more details about that, but, you know, they ended up getting together, making a couple of films, and falling in love with each other.
1953, was this the first film she made with him, Voyage?
No, she made a couple of them. But Voyage to Italy, I think, is the best collaboration that the two of them did. It's a wonderful film where Ingrid Bergman and George Sanders play a couple going to Italy to try and perhaps revive their crumbling relationship. Mm-hmm. And in the process, Ingrid Bergman goes and sees all these relics of Italy's past, including the new recently excavated Pompeii, where couples are being unearthed as they died in death's grasp together. And the artifacts seem to reflect their story, and they are struggling to try and find their marriage again.
I think you ought to know that it didn't take me long after we were married to realize what was wrong. There was always criticism in your eyes, criticism until it crushed me.
Nonsense. But it is rather surprising to hear you say that what I felt was important to you.
What do you mean?
Exactly what I say. You accuse me of criticizing you. Well, it isn't true. Of course, there are a few things which I don't like about you.
I know that.
Your lack of a sense of humor, your ridiculous romanticism.
But when I was reduced in rank from your wife to a mere hostess for your friends and to handling your public relations, you seemed quite pleased.
Now, look, I don't want to talk about this anymore. You know, I'm getting absolutely sick of this crazy country. It poisons you with laziness. I want to get back home, back to work.
Ingrid Bergman, 1953, in Voyage to Italy. Janine Basinger, what was it about this Italian director, Roberto Rossellini, that made Ingrid Bergman fall so hard, and why did it cause such a backlash in the United States?
Well, first of all, she, as he carefully, I mean, very nicely presented to you, fell in love with his work before she fell in love with him. And for an actress, that's key. I mean, she saw him before she ever met him as a great director, a great talent. And, of course, in the actress's tradition, someone she could work with and grow and better her own career. But Rossellini is one of the truly most brilliant men ever to direct films in any country, not just Italy. He was charismatic. He was passionate. He was intelligent. He was talented. And he represented to her a release from the more rigid filmmaking strictures of Hollywood. Making films in the studio system, you worked in a very tight regime, highly structured. And he, of course, made his films more openly, more out in the streets. It was a new kind of filmmaking, and it was exciting to her.
So was their relationship more open and more out in public?
Well, it was very open and out in public. I mean, I can remember I was probably in junior high when the headlines hit our Minneapolis paper that she was having a baby with him when she wasn't married, and this was big news.
She was married to someone else, had children by someone else.
It wasn't a common piece of news that you received on the front page of your newspaper. It was a sort of beginning of the change of morality, the post-war period. She had actually first written to him in 1948, but she didn't meet him until she was making Under Capricorn with Hitchcock in London. She went over to Paris to meet him, and there they planned Stromboli. And when she went off to begin working on Stromboli in early 1949 with Rossellini is when they were swept up in this big affair.
Garen Daly, how big was the scandal? How deeply was Ingrid Bergman vilified?
Oh, she was taken to task. Interestingly enough, do you know who broke the scandal? The guy that broke the scandal was the producer of Stromboli, Howard Hughes. He thought that he would be able to sell more tickets to the film if a big scandal was surrounding it.
So the peaches and cream were a marketing gimmick, and so was the beginning of the scandal.
The beginning of the scandal. But she was really vilified. And again, you have to go back. You know, just a couple years earlier, she was the perfect nun in The Bells of St. Mary's. She was Joan of Arc. She was this personification of all that is good in womanhood. And all of a sudden, she's now telling people that she's pregnant or and it's out of wedlock. This is disgusting. This is terrible.
But the pushback was not just a kind of expose in National Enquirer. It was a real rejection for a time of Ingrid Bergman that hit her career.
I think if we take a look at this, and at least this is my opinion anyways, this is really the beginning of tabloid journalism. This is when the paparazzi were going on. I'm reading in her autobiography how she's being surrounded all the time by photographers who are going through her trash and doing all these really horrible things that we take as a norm now. And I think that feeding frenzy, that media feeding frenzy, turned it into something far greater than it really was.
Janine Basinger, how did it hit her filmmaking and her relationship with the United States?
Well, she was denounced on the floor of Congress. You know, that was a fairly significant thing. I mean, the official, you know, government of the United States said, no, this is unacceptable. That was fairly big.
That she was all that's degrading in Hollywood.
But she didn't really, except for the fact that she separated herself from her daughter, Pia. She moved on with her life. She was living in Europe. She was working with a man she loved. She was giving birth to her son, Roberto, and she was excited about the new life and the new art that had come into her life. So for her, painful, you know, in retrospect, when she writes in her autobiography, you know, she presents a picture of it. But in her diaries and other things, I mean, she had moved on with her life, and this was growth for her in her mind, that she would grow as an actress, she would grow as a woman, as a mother, and, you know, she regretted, I'm sure, had regrets, I'm sure, but she was moving on. It was only when things did not go well between her and Rossellini, neither artistically nor personally, that it began to be different.
What was her sense, her attitude toward the United States, the country that had embraced her and during this period was harshly rejecting her?
I would not answer that question. I mean, I think...
Is it not evident in her letters?
It really, you know, it's an odd thing. I don't think it was a major... I think that...
She didn't say, oh my gosh, these Americans, they just don't understand.
No, she did not.
You know, what I've picked up from her is that this is a person who is very, very centered. She knew who she was. She had not done anything really wrong, and that it was blown out of proportion. So she was just going to be patient and ride this storm out. And she wrote it out with a great deal of class and a great deal of fortitude. And I think when she did make her appearance back in the United States with Anastasia and some of these other films that she made in the late 50s, people were willing to accept the fact that this was a classy lady. And by that time, our moral values had moved up, the country's moral values, to match hers.
Ingrid Bergman later said, I don't regret a thing I've done. I only regret the things I didn't do. That doesn't sound like she was wallowing in shame. We're talking tonight about the life and work of great film actress Ingrid Bergman. Do we still get the Ingrid Bergman mystique, or is it history? Is it now an antique? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the great film actress Ingrid Bergman. A day after the 20th anniversary of her death, she came young from Sweden and was a meteor on the Hollywood silver screen. Here's her 1944 Gaslight, a scene where she plays a woman who's gone mad.
My brooch. The brooch I lost at the tower.
I found it at last, you see? But it doesn't help you, does it? And I'm trying to help you, aren't I? Trying to help you to escape. How can a mad woman help her husband to escape?
But you're not mad.
Yes, I am mad, as my mother was mad.
No, Paula, that wasn't true. Help me.
If I were not mad, I could have helped you. Whatever you had done, I could have pitied and protected you. But because I am mad, I hate you. Because I am mad, I have betrayed you. And because I am mad, I'm rejoicing in my heart without a shred of pity, without a shred of regret, watching you go with glory in my heart. Mr. Cameron, come. Come, Mr. Cameron, take this man away. Take this man away.
Ingrid Bergman in Gaslight, 1944. Jeanine Basinger, I have read that Ingrid Bergman gave this advice to her daughter, Isabella Rossellini, on acting. She said, keep it simple, make a blank face, and the music and the story will fill it in. But what we just heard there didn't sound like the voice attached to a blank face.
No, and I think that was not exactly meant to be anything other than a jocular piece of advice
okay.
to a daughter who, in fact, is extremely beautiful and looks exactly like her mother. But, I mean, I think she did know that you needed to underplay in film, and she did give Isabella that advice also.
Jan's on the line. Welcome, Jan. You're on the air.
What I have is very tangential. I was in Los Angeles during the Second World War, and Hayes ruled,
Of course.
Absolutely. And the big target was Charlie Chaplin.
Mm-hmm.
He was a great immoralist. You know, he was a great moralist.
The womanizer and
right.
Thrashed
he
for
flaunted,
it.
He flaunted his love. But tangentially, my contact was that a young woman who came in and modeled for us, I was a fashion illustrator, was Kathy Hayes, who was not exceptionally beautiful, but everybody said she was beautiful, and she thought she was beautiful because everyone said she was beautiful. But I remember the day she came in and said, we got him, we got him. And they apparently had really gotten it on Charlie Chaplin. So I could imagine the zeal with which they went after.
Was Kathy Hayes related to the Hayes of Oversight?
Yeah, she was his daughter. She would come to the May Company to model. She would be driven by the chauffeur to a bus, and then he found the bus and come to work.
Wow, Jan, so you give us a real flavor of what it was like, the sort of gotcha mentality of that time.
It was a different time, and of course there was also the great Errol Flynn scandals. There were scandals with film stars going back into the 20s. So as the years went by, what changed, I thought, is, you know, what was said earlier is that suddenly, you know, the National Enquirer mentality came in, and we all started reading about these details, which the industry, the film industry, swept under the rug and kept hushed up more, as much as they could during the 30s and 40s.
Ingrid Bergman faded for a time from the American screen, by and large, but she had a significant comeback, Ghirardelli.
Yeah, she came back with Anastasia, which she won an Academy Award for, playing the supposed lost daughter of the last Tsar of Russia. A wonderful film, and if you ever get a chance to see it.
It's terrific.
It's terrific. Her final scenes with Helen Hayes, another great American actor, is simply superb.
Off the charts.
And it still stands up. When these two go toe-to-toe, she also made The End of Sixth Happiness, Indiscreet. She also ended up going and doing a couple of other films. She ended up working on Murder on the Orient Express.
1974,
directed by Sidney Lumet. And again, it's a wonderful ensemble cast. And here's a little clip from that.
I was born backwards. That is why I work in Africa as missionary, teaching little brown babies more backward than myself.
But I see that you have spent 3 months in America. Were you not able to improve?
I was I international group for getting money for African mission from American rich. I speak Swedish to big audiences in Swedish American institution in Minneapolis and other big cities.
Minneapolis. Ingrid Bergman going on 60 in 1974 in Murder on the Orient Express. Jeanine Basinger, I have to admit, it's not just her luminous beauty. I felt my old family Swedish strain just melting my heart every time I watch her on screen. But when you look at that kind of, this wasn't a finely boned woman exactly. There's a fully substantial woman there. and a kind of ski jump nose that we don't see much on the screen today. Would this look as if Ingrid Bergman were young today? Do you think it would still carry the kind of va-voom physical attraction that it did in the 40s?
Well, of course, today I guess it would have to be wearing leather and Manolo Blahniks, right? But, I mean, I think that I can speak for my students, a younger generation, mm-hmm. who find her exciting and beautiful. I mean, and, of course, her daughter, Isabella Rossellini, mm-hmm. has had, in the modern time, a substantial career and is thought of as a beautiful and desirable woman. I think that Ingrid Bergman's looks are classic, and she is a beautiful woman in any era because she's simple with her beauty. It isn't tarted up. It isn't designed. It isn't reflecting an era's peculiar attitude toward beauty. It's classic. It's a beauty that's there for the ages.
And Garen Daly, in a word, Ingrid Bergman's quality of acting, do we still see it in contemporary actresses?
Absolutely. I think she is one of the people that other actors like Julia Stiles or Cate Blanchett looked to Ingrid Bergman's style and the way that she used the camera and how she acted as, you know, a roadmap for them to do their own work today.
Some roadmap. That's a beautiful one. Garen Daly, owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, and On Point's movie maven, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure, always.
And Janine Basinger, it's been great to have you on. Thanks so much for joining us.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Janine Basinger is professor of film studies at Wesleyan University and curator of the Wesleyan Cinema Archives. Let's go out listening to Ingrid Bergman. This is a song originally written by Woody Guthrie, put to music and sung here by Billy Bragg. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Ingrid Bergman, Ingrid Bergman, let's go make a picture on the island of Stromboli. Ingrid Bergman, Ingrid Bergman, you're so pretty, you'd make any mountain quiver, you'd make fire fly from the crater. Ingrid Bergman, this old mountain, it's been waiting all its life for you to work it, for your hand to touch its hard rock. Ingrid Bergman.
In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
Simply stated, there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction. There is no doubt that he is amassing them to use them against our friends, against our allies, and against us. And there is no doubt that his aggressive regional ambitions will lead him into future confrontations with his neighbors. The risk of inaction are far greater than the risk of action.
A Saudi official is reaffirming his country's opposition to military action against Iraq. The comment from a Saudi foreign policy advisor came this morning just before a meeting between President Bush and Saudi Arabia's ambassador at Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas.
In unanimity, we often find an absence of rigorous thinking. And it's more important, it's less important to have unanimity than it is to be making the right decisions and doing the right thing.
I am deeply gratified and very, very happy to report that Major League Baseball's 30 clubs and the Major League Baseball Players Association have today reached an historic agreement and that all games will be played as scheduled.
It's the most dramatic turnaround in the nation's fiscal fortune since World War II. Last year, the federal budget was in triple-digit surplus. This year, triple-digit deficit, $157 billion. And the CBO says that red ink will continue until the year 2006.
It's difficult, you know, 20 years to life, just difficult to compare that to what life would have been like without Martha, with Martha. There's no such thing as fair here. Yeah, there's no celebration. There's no party to go to.
Among the many things I learned as president of our country was the centrality of water in the social, political, and economic affairs of the country, and indeed, the world. I am therefore a totally committed water person.
And there's a week, Dick Cheney makes the case for war in Iraq. Saudi Arabia's ambassador meets with President Bush at the Crawford Ranch and urges him not to attack. Donald Rumsfeld says we'll go it alone if necessary. 11th hour negotiations head off a baseball strike. The Congressional Budget Office says big deficits are back with us. And for the next several years, Kennedy cousin Michael Skakel is sentenced to 20 years to life in prison for the 1975 murder of Martha Moxley. And Nelson Mandela talks on water at the World Summit on Sustainable Development in Johannesburg, South Africa. Jack Beatty, Iraq just won't go away. Dick Cheney is making it the heartbeat of America this week.
He is, along with Donald Rumsfeld. They're really making the president's case, and maybe that's just as well. The president was quoted yesterday in Oklahoma City saying, and I quote, "There's no cave deep for America or dark enough to hide." I guess he was talking about Osama bin Laden. The drums are beating. A British military expert was quoted today as saying that in view of all the pre-positioning of equipment and that sort of thing that went on after the first Gulf War, war could begin as early as 2 weeks.
And yet, Jack, there's a little sense of tension still in the air. Bush 1's advisors have come out to advise against doing this without the UN, without inspections. And even Bush himself this week is keeping that line in the water. Harvard's Joe Nye was on with us this week, no slouch and pretty well connected. And he said he really believes it's still a 50-50 chance that Bush will take the consultation UN route rather than the straight to war path.
Well, let's hope he does. I mean, I think that everybody can agree that it would be better if we had allies. It might even be better that if we didn't do it at all, if the Iraqis accepted the inspections. But I think we have to look at the political calculations, too. And Karl Rove, as we know, his political advisor, plays a large hand in these decisions. And there are two elections coming up, one in November and one in 2004. And if they're going to do a war, Rove is going to be involved in the planning, and they're going to say, well, where can we get the best bounce out of it? Out of the 2002 election, where we could, you know, we're holding on, we get maybe the one seat back in the Senate, or the hold on to our lead in the House, or should we hold it off until after that and aim to dominate things in 2004? In any case, politics will play a huge role in the calculation, because it always does in these questions. However distressing that is for people to have to face that, the presidents could actually think about such things in planning war. They do. They have.
Hate to see war as a political football. We did see a good bounce on a baseball strike this week, though, Jack. It's not going to happen.
Yes, thank heaven, a heartening display of reason at the brink. Maybe we're going to see more of that. The players compromised, perhaps more than the owners. I think they read the tea leaves, didn't they, that the public was not seeing it their way at all. And it can only be heartening to Red Sox fans to see that the Yankees are going to have to be paying this royalty tax. Perhaps the Red Sox won't. That's always good to see. And we probably need a gripping World Series again this year. We may need to be distracted from a lot, and if we have a World Series that's anything like last year's, it'll be worthwhile. So play ball!
Play ball. We may need the great American pastime for a while if the Congressional Budget Office is right. We've got big deficits coming down the pike, and they're going to be with us for a long time.
They are, and they'll get deeper if the president has his way. He wants to cut tax on dividends. That would 47% of that would go to the top 1%. So he wants to cut those too, and so that'll deepen the deficit some more.
Well, there's a deep, dark hole to sit in. Jack Beatty, have a great weekend.
Okay.
On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog. Special thanks and good luck to Virginia Prescott. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Have a great weekend. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.